Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
A mid-19th century Irish politician, Daniel O'Connell, once said, "England's difficulty is Ireland's opportunity." Whether one applauds or is appalled by Brexit, there is a broader consensus of opinion which agrees that the plan, or rather the lack of plan, for Britain's departure from the European Union will lead to difficulties for England. More dire prognosticators would argue that description is a classic example of British understatement and would suggest the word disaster be used instead. Ireland is the closest, most interconnected nation in the European Union with the UK. As unclear as Britain's path forward is, something equally unclear is whether Brexit will be the opportunity for Ireland that O'Connell's maxims suggest it could be, or whether the United Kingdom, crashing out of the EU, will poach Europe's resilient Celtic tiger. Hello, everybody. I'm Tom Daly, host of the American Biography Podcast. Today, the Agora Podcast Network has something of a, well, I don't want to use the word treat here, but let's just say, in recognition of St. Patrick's Day, we're going to be doing something that doesn't happen often. We're going to shine a spotlight on how international events are affecting the Republic of Ireland's present and how they may impact its future. To do this, we're going to be leaning heavily on the expertise of our dear history friend, host of the When Diplomacy Fails podcast and the lecturer for Irish politics, European Union economics, and European Union integration at the Technical University of Dublin, Zach Twomley. Zach, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Zach, as you were made aware on your recent trip to Massachusetts last fall, almost everybody on this side of the pond can claim at least one Irish ancestor. So you also won't be surprised that Irish Americans like myself are intrinsic experts on everything having to do with the old country. So I probably won't get much out of this conversation, but hopefully I can teach you a thing or two about your own country.
Oh, I hope so.
Yes. Now, I kid, obviously. And we're very lucky to have you, someone of your expertise.
Oh, wow.
But before we dig in, I did want to reiterate how wonderful it was to spend time with you and meet your lovely wife, Anna, at the Sound Education Podcast Conference last fall at Harvard.
Oh, it was fab. It was such a pleasure. And, you know, I was only saying a while ago, it feels like another lifetime ago that happened. It was only a few months, but since everything has happened and everything, the whole experience of going to America and going to Harvard and meeting you guys, meeting you and meeting people from Agora, meeting fans as well, it was incredible. Such a wonderful experience.
It really was a unique and special experience. And you know, we actually delivered back-to-back lectures in the very same room.
Hell yeah!
And you spoke and you spoke very eloquently then about the romanticization of the Easter Rising of 1916, and which you've also produced an amazing podcast series about for When Diplomacy Fails.
Yes. Yes, awesome. Indeed.
Now, I've often wondered, did you take any heat for that series?
Well, by heat, I mean, okay, so heat can mean a lot of things. It could mean a very, very strongly worded email, which I got a few of, or it could mean being kneecapped and left to die in an alleyway. I didn't get the latter yet, but I did
that's good.
Yes, it is. I did get certainly a good few of the first, but it wasn't too bad. It was nothing I couldn't handle, and for the most part, I just ignored them, because something I've learned from being on Twitter, especially in the last few weeks, that if someone comes at you with very strong opinions, by and large, you're not going to persuade them to change their minds. And if you have a busy schedule in your life, then it takes an awful lot of time to think up a response and all this kind of thing. And it's often not even worth it in the end. So I learned to pick my battles, and most of the time just not fight any battles at all.
Now, I don't know if right here at the top you want to put your views into context when it comes to Ireland, because, you know, to pull back the curtain, the reason for my little joke about Irish Americans there being experts is the fact that the vast majority of people outside of Ireland, even those who are of proud Irish descent, probably don't have an appreciation for where Ireland's domestic political fault lines may lay.
Sure. Well, to me, and this is I have to emphasize, and I did emphasize this a lot in the 1916 series, to my mind, the 1916 Rising was one of the worst things that happened to this country, mostly because of all the things it set in motion, all the falsehoods it seemed to legitimize, and all of the good stuff it pretty much did away with. So, to my mind, things like physical force republicanism, this idea that you can win somehow by killing the other side, even if that side that you're fighting against is the same size as you, or this idea that by setting off several bombs all over the place, you will actually somehow win a war, even when most of the time the people that suffer are civilians. These approaches to actually getting your own way, unfortunately, that's the kind of thing that the 1916 Rising legitimized, and in my view, it's really a terrible thing. And it's extra terrible because today, on the one hand, we are taught that that kind of behavior is wrong, but then on the other hand, we're also taught that the 1916 Rising was a good thing. And if you disagree with that point of view, it's almost as though there's something wrong with you. And if you're in among certain people, say at the pub especially, you wouldn't go into a pub and say the 1916 Rising was a bad thing, because 9 times out of 10, there will be a Proclamation of the Republic document on the wall somewhere in a frame. So it wouldn't be the greatest idea to do that. But to me, I've accepted it. I've let it roll off me, because I realize that it is difficult for people to grasp the fact that what we've been told this time is wrong. And I know it's a cliche, oh, don't believe what the man tells you and everything like that. And I'm a big believer in the idea that we should trust journalists, but we should fact check them and all that kind of thing. But I think in the case of the 1916 Rising, it is a lie that's been pushed upon us. And if you even look at the history of it, because it's not all that long ago that it wasn't looked on as a wonderful thing. There was contentious views around it. And not until really about the 60s did this narrative become, mostly from the 50th anniversary, really, this romantic idea of the 1916 Rising, like the perpetrators of it, oh, they were so brave, or they acted for all of us, and they kicked out the British, and they achieved our independence. None of those three things are true. They were a minority within a minority within a minority. They didn't actually achieve any independence for us at all. All we got in the end was home rule, except without Northern Ireland, which is very topical now that we're talking about Northern Ireland already. It's the first of many mentions of it. But it didn't work. We were stuck as a dominion within the British Empire for another generation. And ironically, not until De Valera started to use his political leverage throughout the 30s, did Ireland actually achieve any modicum of independence? But still, even though De Valera went through that process and saw what politics could achieve, and even though he saw how useless, really, like, violence was, he still tried to perpetrate this myth that the Rising was this wonderful thing that achieved our independence. And you'll still find people today that see it as a wonderful thing, even though in the same breath they condemn what happened in the North with the Troubles, where the Nationalists and the Unionists attacked one another. They'll condemn that, but they'll see it as fine when some random group of rebels decide to rise up in Dublin City and, as a result, several hundred people die who had nothing to do with it, including women and children and everything else, and including British army soldiers who were actually Irish boys who were just there because they needed a job. So there you go.
Yeah, and that, as you said, like, that led to the partition of the North in home rule, and that led to civil war. And isn't, if I'm not an expert on your domestic politics either, but I feel like your two major political parties in Parliament actually come out of that question of the partition of Ireland, whether to accept home rule or to not accept home rule. So that brings it all the way up to today, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely it does. And do you know, to be honest, if you ask people these days where Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, our two main political parties, come from, if you ask them where they come from, for the most part, they probably won't know, because it's a little bit tricky. Both of the parties pretty much came out of Sinn Féin, which people might have heard of, because Sinn Féin is still a political party in itself. But I think one of the main themes we're going to come across today, Tom, is that all of this stuff is quite complicated, and it does require a bit of explanation. It's not as simple as the Rising was good and that's that, or Brexit means Brexit, or let's just leave, or anything like that. There is too many different layers to just jump into things super quickly in that sense. But to answer your question as briefly as I can answer it, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil both spun off from the Sinn Féin party. Fine Gael, or Cum An na Gael, the Council of Gaels, as it was called in the 1920s, it started off as this what's called pro-treaty. In other words, its members predominantly were ones that signed the peace treaty with the British, which ended the Anglo-Irish War, or War of Independence. And the other side, which became Fianna Fáil, was opposed to the treaty and fought against the people that signed it during the Civil War. The Civil War only lasted a few months, but in that space of time, more people died in the Civil War than died in the War of Independence. So it was a very difficult, awful time for people in Ireland. It turned family against family, because it made them choose between whether they wanted to pursue peace or whether they were so opposed to the treaty that had been signed with Britain that they wanted to keep on with the violence. And the violence wouldn't be directed against the British. It would be directed against their own people, the Irish people. So it's a real tragedy today. Funnily enough, the Civil War is seen as a massive waste, whereas the War of Independence is seen as an inherently good thing by and large. It's seen as something to be proud of because we fought against the British and we quote-unquote won that fight, even though we certainly did not. We held our own for a little while, but I mean, the writing was on the wall. The whole reason why we had to engage in guerrilla warfare tactics, etc., is because, I mean, to put it in perspective, we were trying to face off against the biggest empire in the world at that point, even after the First World War had decimated the British finances and military and everything else. So, getting all over the place to answer your question, very, very roundabout way and not all that brief at all. Yes, the two main political parties today are Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Fianna Fáil originally being anti-treaty and Fine Gael being pro-treaty, but these days you wouldn't really notice too much differences between them, and certainly they don't call themselves pro or anti-treaty anymore. The only time you ever really hear that rhetoric is if, again, you're down in the pub or you're having some lighthearted conversations with friends about Irish politics, perhaps. But to keep on continuing to answer this question, since 2016, the general election there didn't return a majority for Fine Gael. So currently what's going on is there's this thing called a confidence and supply agreement between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Fianna Fáil is essentially propping up a minority Fine Gael government. And as a result of that, people are starting to see that there's 158 TDs, so 158 seats in our Dáil, in our parliament. And out of that, the vast majority of them would be Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael seats. They're the two largest parties in the country. There's also Labour, there's still a nascent Sinn Féin party as well. Social Democrats are a small party too. So there is other parties, but by and large, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael run the shots. And because they're essentially in coalition but not quite in coalition with this agreement that they have. People are starting to think maybe there's not that many differences between them at all, but it's unlikely that they'll merge because they've been apart for so long, but some people certainly hope that they would just merge and get on with it.
That does sound complicated, and yep. Unfortunately, yeah, unfortunately, we're about to introduce Brexit into this equation, and that's mm-hmm. not going to help at all. So, so we're speaking on March 15th.
Sure.
3 days ago, Prime Minister of the UK, Theresa May, was delivered another decisive defeat in her amended Brexit plan. 2 days ago, MPs voted to reject a no deal or a hard Brexit. And yesterday, MPs in British Parliament voted to delay Brexit to as late as the end of June and also rejected the idea of a second referendum.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the time this is edited and released, honestly, who the heck knows what'll be happening?
Yeah.
But as it stands now, what are the realistic prospects for Brexit? And what are their likely implications for Theresa May's government?
Right. Well, this is going to probably be a fairly long-winded answer. What I'm going to try and do here is go over, for those that don't know, because there's going to be a lot of confusion, because there's confusion all over the place at the moment as what's happened in those 3 days, in Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And I'm going to do my best to unpack them a little bit. But first things first, to answer your question before I go off on a tangent, I have looked, Tom, at a whole load of stuff to get in preparation with this. And I am, of course, plugged in anyway to what's going on with Brexit. But every single time I listen to something where it says, and by and large I'm listening to podcasts, where it says, oh, so-and-so is going to tell us what this means about Brexit or what this means for the country, the conclusion is always, yeah, we don't know. All the time, people are saying, we don't know what's going to happen with Brexit. We know what the pathway is. We know what the different amendments mean. We know what the timeline is for Theresa May. We know that next Wednesday she's going to bring a third attempt at her meaningful vote on her deal. We also know that in order for it to successfully happen, we know that in the European Council, the different heads of the EU will have to actually approve an extension, full stop. So we know that she'll have until the end of June to make things happen as well. But we don't know in the meantime if any of that stuff will work. Anything could come up in the meantime to stop that. Will Theresa May be able to actually persuade the DUP to side with her? And we'll talk about the DUP soon. Will she be able to persuade the European Council's different heads to actually approve her deal? It's all up in the air. Do I think Brexit will happen? You see, it's tinged with the fact that I super don't want it to happen. But if it's going to happen, I believe that the only way it will happen is with an amended version of Theresa May's deal, purely because that's the deal that's been worked on for so many years. And as has been made very clear by Theresa May, she does not want to let go of it. She's going to go back now to the House on Wednesday for the third time. She has to amend it slightly. She can't just bring back the exact same deal again. But this is what I'll get into with something of the hypocrisy. And I'm not gonna make any effort to hide my feelings on how I feel about Brexit in this, which I hope is okay with you. But
this is not a history thing we're talking
sure.
about. We're talking about current politics here.
Oh yeah.
So you're wearing a different hat than you would on your podcast, and
yes.
I think all the listeners should be understanding of that.
Oh, I think they will be, but it's not even just in the podcast. In lecturing as well, I have to maintain an unbiased perspective, though it does pain me sometimes to do that, and I think I probably don't do it as well as I could. But yes, in any case, the situation with Brexit is that I'd say that it'll pass with May's deal, an amended version of it. What you say what you will about the hypocrisy of coming back time and time again, making everyone in Parliament vote on another deal when they say we can't vote again on a referendum. It's a bit bizarre, but there you go. That's the double standards, the double speak of this whole situation we're in. But I do think Theresa May could even go for a fourth vote if she wanted. She is facing pressures in her party from the European Research Group. That'd be the main group of Eurosceptics. They'd be about 110 MPs. There's 650 seats in the House of Commons. So you can imagine out of that, it's a sizable portion. But it also shows how kind of precarious her position actually is. She's missed out on a majority with her minority government only by a few seats, which is why she was so reliant on the 10 DUPs in the first place. But there you go. It's a difficult situation. Do I think it'll pass? I think it will. purely because Theresa May is going to keep hammering it home. Do I want it to? Absolutely not. And it's hard sometimes for me to balance the whole wanting it to and trying to be realistic. But at the same time, I'm hopeful that anything can happen. So I know I realize that's a very inconclusive answer for you.
I mean, it is, because as you point out, who knows? Like, you say Theresa May needs to amend something to bring back to MPs. The EU, to my understanding, has said, we're done.
Yeah.
We have nothing left to give you. So, you know, and negotiations between the EU and the UK really hit a significant roadblock over the question of North Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was wondering if perhaps you could give us some more of that background as to why this question is so contentious. And now, it doesn't have to be crazy in depth. Say, maybe just go back to Oliver Cromwell.
Are you sure? I could go back to William the Conqueror if you prefer. Let me see, digging through my notes here. What the main thing that I have learned about Northern Ireland is how little people actually know of it or understand it. This is the short version is that in 1998, what was called the Good Friday Agreement was signed, which essentially brought peace to Northern Ireland. It ended the conflict called the Troubles between the Nationalists and the Unionists, or the Catholics and the Protestants, respectively, that had been fought. Now, that is a generalization, but just to breeze through it as much as we can here. It ended that conflict and it brought about a kind of power-sharing agreement to the island. Now, that's good on the one hand, but the problem with that is that once the conflict ended and once Northern Ireland left the political and public consciousness of the British and Irish press, people started talking about it less. Now, over here in Ireland, Northern Ireland is known of, and we know what it is and we know what it means by and large. But in the UK, it's different because, to my understanding, in the UK, they're not taught about Irish history in school. Whereas, while we're not taught about British history in school, maybe people don't care. But because of my own interest, I actually do know a fair bit about it. And in the case of Northern Ireland, the problem is that the less that Northern Ireland was talked about, because the less relevant it wasn't coming up in the news, etc., the British had more than enough to worry about. Suddenly you get a whole generation of people who grew up, even in the 90s, or just briefly after Good Friday Agreement was signed, who don't know anything about Northern Ireland. And that might sound bad in itself, but listen, get a load of this, right? Northern Ireland is a part of the United Kingdom. It is a constituent part of the United Kingdom. It has a devolved government, devolved parliament at Stormont and everything else. So if you as a UK citizen, if you as a British citizen living in England or Scotland, whatever, don't know what the story is with Northern Ireland, it means that you don't actually know where the borders of your state end or begin. It means you don't know what the legal status of your country is. It means you don't know a whole load of things. But don't think that this ignorance is just restricted to normal people. It's also extended to the people that are supposed to be in charge and supposed to know what's going on. And we'll talk about this again. We'll come back to this again. This idea that when they were talking about Brexit in 2016, when they were talking about taking back control and giving £350 million more a year to the NHS and all that kind of thing, no one stopped to think about what it meant for Northern Ireland. And with that Good Friday Agreement that I mentioned, it was enshrined within that there would never be a hard border on the island of Ireland again, because it would be a surefire way to ensure conflict once more. But no one stopped to think about what would happen if, theoretically at that point, because they didn't know if they would leave or not, if Northern Ireland left with the UK, if it left the EU and became part of a different market and all this kind of thing, you'd need different tariffs and everything. It would be part of a different customs union. It'd be part of a different trade area. So you need to set up some kind of checks or balances to make sure that the different standards and everything were applied. So you need to set up different areas for checking those things on the border. So while this was loudly pointed to by certain people in Ireland, it wasn't, I would argue, it wasn't pointed to loudly enough by people in the Irish government at the time, who kind of just let the British go for it without really saying, hold on, guys, this will really affect us. Now, Northern Ireland voted to remain in the United, in the European Union by 55%. So it was really only England that voted to leave as a majority. Scotland was 62%, I believe. Oh, and Wales as well voted to leave, which is bizarre considering how much funding they get. But in any case, with the... Sorry, what was the original question?
Why is the North Ireland question so contentious between the EU and the UK?
Right. Well, the whole thing boils down to history and context and how terrified people are of things going back to the Troubles era, where for most of the 70s and 80s and parts of the 90s as well, it was all over the news. Someone got killed, someone got shot in the north, a bomb went off, children were killed for no reason. More than 3,500 people died during the Troubles. And while that might not seem like a lot, for a population of only really about a million, about 1.3, 1.2 million, it's quite a sizable amount. And it wasn't just the deaths, it was also the fact that it pervaded everything. And it also, the more conflict there was, the more tit-for-tat killings there was, it engendered this sense of us versus them. And that's why it proved so difficult to actually solve. And I mentioned this at the end of the 1916 Rising series. The thing that's so admirable about the whole peace process in Northern Ireland is that it's not just like, oh, two sides fought a war and that was it. This was for a generation where my brother killed your brother, and now we both have to sit down and hammer this peace out so that our children don't go through the same thing. I know for a fact that you killed my brother, and you know for a fact that I killed yours, but we're going to do this now because we have to, otherwise this will go on forever. And it takes an awful lot of maturity to reach that stage, and for a long time Northern Ireland wasn't there yet, and it only really got there in 1998, and even then not completely. It wasn't until the early 2000s that Sinn Féin and the Democratic Unionist Party agreed to share power together. And even then, it was an imperfect situation, but it's certainly better than what is there now. But in any case, to everyone in Ireland, and both North and South, the last thing they want is a return to the old ways with violence. And the belief is that that's the exact situation a hard border will bring about. That a hard border is all it will take to touch off a new cycle of violence, which nobody in the right mind wants. Those that insist, and I'm sure we'll come back to this later, those that insist that a hard border can't possibly come about because nobody wants a hard border is like saying, I don't know, saying, well, we will get the perfect trade deal, or we will never go to war because nobody wants to go to war. You cannot predict what's going to happen. And if you take yourselves out of international agreements, By the word of international law, you must be under some kind of arrangement. And if you're not in the European Union, you're in something else. And if you're in that something else, and you share a border with someone who is in the EU, then you need to have some kind of system in place to make sure those checks and balances are done properly. And the only way to do that is with a border, unfortunately. And that's why people are so afraid. They don't want the violence to come back, and they know that if the UK leaves with Northern Ireland, then there will be a border, no matter what people say.
Okay, so I think it's easy to understand that an aversion to rekindling this generational violence is a big motivator from the Irish perspective as to why you want to maintain that open border.
Mm-hmm.
To flip it around, though, why is this question of the border being open such a problem for the UK's Tory government and Brexit hardliners?
Well, the reason why it's such a problem is because when you look at Northern Ireland and you think of possible solutions to it, there's very few solutions other than staying in the same customs union, staying in the same single market, etc. There's very few solutions that come to mind. So this is where the idea of the backstop came from. And there's a lot of confusion around the backstop. The backstop is essentially, it's pressing pause on the process of Northern Ireland leaving the customs union, leaving the EU, and it's saying, let's leave Northern Ireland in the same customs union, same single market, etc., as the island of Ireland. So they're all in the same situation, but only until the end of 2020. In the meantime, UK, you guys figure out exactly how we're going to make this work. And then once you figure it out, then we'll move out of the backstop and move into something else. So it's a temporary arrangement. But the problem with the backstop, for those that fear its implications, they think that what it'll do is leave Northern Ireland basically subject to the whims of the EU. And that's why, even though it seems like the idea of this free open border is the problem. What's really the problem is the backstop to people who fear, they don't so much fear an open border, because that's what people want. They want the border to stay open and free and permeable and everything else, like the way it is now, where you could get on a train from Dublin to Belfast like you couldn't do that 30 or 40 years ago. That's not what they're afraid of. They're afraid of this suggestion by the EU to keep that system going. Now, to my mind, it is a bit odd to get all hung up about it, because first of all, the EU has made it perfectly clear over and over again that the last thing they want is to fan any kind of flames in Northern Ireland. I mean, nobody wants to be in Northern Ireland. It's often said the British don't even want to be in Northern Ireland anymore, and yet they're stuck there with the massive bills and basically propping up the economy of that small portion of the island. All that aside, do we think that the backstop is a good idea? Yes, but it's only supposed to be a temporary thing. And not only that, it's not only just supposed to be a temporary thing, it was also only supposed to be an emergency measure. All this time spent worrying about the backstop, all this time spent saying, oh, the backstop is terrible, it's going to keep us tied to the EU, it's going to keep us away from the UK where we want to be. You would understand those fears if the backstop was literally the suggestion that the EU brought forward as the be-all and end-all that was going to keep Northern Ireland stuck to the EU forever. It was supposed to be an emergency measure and it was supposed to be temporary, but there's been so much pontificating and rhetoric about how to actually stop the backstop. No one's thought to actually say, hold on, this wasn't what the EU wanted. This was an emergency measure in case the UK didn't find a solution. And of course, they haven't found a solution in the last 2 years when they've been discussing this. And when Theresa May's deal was brought forward, they singled out backstop as this bugbear of the Democratic Unionist Party, as this supposed silent, sneaky way for the EU to keep us away from the United Kingdom. And they focused on it without really thinking of what it meant. And it did not mean the stuff they said it to mean. All it meant was a temporary measure that would only be brought in if nothing else had come up. And the idea was that at the end of 2020, it would be run out and you would be able to do some other arrangements, but none of the arrangements they're suggesting will actually work. I mean, for crying out loud, the United Kingdom, it is a great country, and I know several people there and everything, and I'm very fond of them, but they got freaked out by a drone in Heathrow. I don't think they're ready for any, like, technological arrangements or alternative arrangements that they've brought up, and without any ever actually specifying what they mean. So it's just, it's dire, but this whole idea of the backstop, people are getting it way out of whack. They're focusing on it far too unnecessarily, where there's really no need to get so obsessed about it.
Yeah, I've seen it referred to as a backdoor annexation.
Yeah,
And that seems a bit much. I mean, and I mean, from my side of the Atlantic, I think Irish nationalism is much more represented. You know, I on the bus in Boston riding to work, I used to go past a mural of 26 plus 6 equals 1 on the side of a liquor store. so, you know, so it's very much what I see. What do the Northern Irish actually want?
Well, the funny thing, I suppose not the funny thing, but the odd thing about the Democratic Unionist Party, those 10 DUP MPs that are supporting or not supporting Theresa May at the moment, the odd thing about them is that in Stormont, they only have 27 seats of the Legislative Assembly that's in Northern Ireland. So the Legislative Assembly is called Stormont, and it has 90 seats. 27 of those are DUP members. They stand for arguably the more hardline version of unionism. They also stand for social conservatism. They're against abortion. They're against same-sex marriage and everything else. So they are holding firm to a very specific, like, demographic within Northern Ireland. And that is by no means, if you ever go to Northern Ireland, it is by and large a very tolerant place, a very nice place to be. Now, if you go to certain areas and start waving a tricolour around, you're going to get in trouble, but that could be the same could be said in most parts of the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't what the problem with the DUP representing Northern Ireland is that they're doing the exact opposite. They are misrepresenting what Northern Ireland really is. if you instead had the likes of Sinn Féin in addition to the DUP, because Sinn Féin also has 27 out of 90 seats in Stormont, but Sinn Féin are abstaining from going to Westminster, because they've always abstained from going to Westminster, because their mantra is that if they go to Westminster and sit there, then they're legitimizing the occupation of the North, and they're legitimizing the British control over the North. But because of that unfortunate policy, instead of having what Northern Ireland actually is, people are going to, and already have been, equating Northern Ireland with this very backward, very outdated, very conservative in the extreme version view of what Northern Ireland really is. Of course, people voted for those DUP representatives, and they voted for those 10 DUP MPs too, but by and large, they do not represent the majority of opinion. I saw an opinion poll recently which said that 67% of Northern Irish people do not believe in the vision of Brexit that this DUP party is pushing for. Now, I know you could say an awful lot about polls, you can criticize them till the cows come home,
yeah.
But even if there's margin for error, all that kind of thing, I'm sure it's not the first time that the DUP has been painted in that light. And it seems to me a real shame that one of the first pictures that international observers get of Northern Ireland is the DUP, which in a very big way, they are not good representatives of what Northern Ireland is all about. Northern Ireland is not, for the most part, socially conservative, intolerant, all that kind of thing. It is trying to bring itself up on par with what Ireland has become in the last decade. And it's being blocked by the unionist perspective. Now, not all unionists are like that, and I don't want anyone listening in Northern Ireland to think that I'm against all unionists. I have several friends who are, in fact, unionists, and I completely respect their view and their opinion. But the Democratic Unionist Party, as opposed to the smaller Ulster Unionist Party, the UUP, see, this is why it's complicated. There is two unionist parties, and there's also independent unionists as well, all of them sitting in Stormont. The Ulster Unionist Party only has 10 seats in Stormont, whereas the Democratic Unionist Party has 27. So the Democratic Unionist Party is the larger of the two unionist parties, and it also the more hard line. But moods and attitudes and opinions have become more tolerant, certainly towards the nationalists, towards Catholics and everything else. The odd thing is that while that tolerance between the two communities has certainly increased, you also get a reaction almost within the Unionist Party to become more conservative in other respects. So on social issues, on religious issues, on the right to life of the unborn, on same-sex marriage, all these kinds of things. So I'm sorry, again, I've forgotten the question, but hopefully I gave you some few answers
there. No, you're still on point there. It's the Northern Irish perspective.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah.
Now, I do want to hop over to a different kind of set of questions. You've mentioned several times so far about, you know, you would need to put a hard border in there because of tariffs and other economic changes that would occur should Brexit actually ever happen. Now, what would the economic consequences for the Republic of Ireland be when the UK leaves the EU?
Oh boy. Well, I mean, take your pick. First and foremost, the UK is our biggest trading partner within the EU bloc. We certainly do get, we have great deals with other members, but purely by law of geography, they are our biggest trading partner. And it's a wonderful system that we have now where in the single market, you're trading with the UK as if you're trading within a single country. There is no non-tariff barriers or no different standards. There is the currency issue, but because it's the euro and not the pound versus the Irish punt as we used to have. Irish punt, like that was our old currency beforehand. It was very much modeled on the pound, unsurprisingly, because that's sort of what we'd been under before. Mm-hmm. But now that we have the euro and we're trading through the pound, and it's a very good system. The only thing we really have to worry is exchange rate fluctuations, which for the most part don't affect us all that much. But the biggest problem that people foresee if the UK leaves is that, well, we'll be subject to completely new regulations, as will the United Kingdom. So suddenly those trading in beef, those trading in milk, those trading in grains, agriculture will be our main export to the UK. And the UK is famous for its brilliant services industry, which makes up 80% of their exports, I believe. And within that, if you suddenly have a load of tariffs piled on top of everything where they weren't there before, it's going to be catastrophic. And for years, well, for the last 2 years, when people talk about a no-deal Brexit as this boogeyman of Anglo-Irish trade, they do so with good reason, because even in the areas where people are struggling, and this goes for British traders as well, when they export to us and when they import from us, both sides will be affected. For Ireland, it's going to be pretty devastating, but at least on the other hand, we will have, as a backup plan, we will have our other European Union trading partners. And if we have to, I suppose we will change our habits. Perhaps we will become more internationalized by virtue of the UK being difficult, but we will never be able to completely escape trading with the United Kingdom. And because of that, we will never be able to completely avoid the damage. That's why when people talk about a no-deal Brexit and when they talk about it potentially leading to recession in the United Kingdom, in the same breath, you could often hear people saying that, well, the same thing will happen to Ireland, because while our economies aren't as interdependent as they were in the 60s and 70s before we joined the EU, now, even now, there is still an awful lot of interdependence. And it goes both ways. Obviously, we're only an island of 6 million people here, whereas the UK have 10 times and more of that. So you're going to get discrepancies, you're going to get imbalances. But we are quite dependent upon each other and we have a good working relationship going. And that's why it makes me so angry and so upset that for the sake of some not very well defined reasons, this is all going to go down the drain now unless it can be stopped. It's going to be catastrophic for Ireland, and all you have to do to find that out is you could search Brexit Irish farmers and you'll see an awful lot of depressing headlines and depressing news right then and there.
Oh man. So speaking of going down the drain, I have to ask now, are there dangers for the Irish character in all of this? And what I mean is, I have read that certain politicians and parties within the Irish political system are sort of playing off these tensions Brexit is creating to exploit Irish nationalistic fervor, you know, in order to improve their domestic standing. Now, I've seen this phenomenon referred to as waving the green jersey. I don't know if that's what you guys actually call it. I mainly get that from American news outlets. But in general, you know, as nationalism is a rising problem worldwide, and we've seen that liberal democracies in the West are not immune to it, is there a danger that by doing this, you're opening a door to these darker impulses, similar to, you know, what gave rise to Brexit in the first place?
Yeah, I completely understand that. And I have to say that in all this absolute nonsense and awful stuff that's happened, I have to say I've been very proud of how Ireland's responded to it and how we haven't really gone down any dark political paths. The main thing that worries people is the financial aspects of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Nigel Farage and a few other people tried to set up an IREXIT party, an Irish European Union exit party, and they were mostly laughed at. I don't know anyone who thinks of an Irish exit from the EU as a credible thing. We are insulted regularly with how wrong British people seem to get the Irish character and how they just suggest that, oh, Ireland should leave the EU as well and join with the UK, as if that's just something that has never happened and never gone badly before, you know? It really hasn't showed up the British, certain aspects of the British people, politicians, it hasn't showed them up in a particularly good light. But I'm happy to say that for us, the main thing is financial worries. We are not all that worried politically about how this is going to affect Ireland. I mean, domestic politics, it's weird to say this in a way, but I think we got it out of our system with the Troubles. That's a probably very insensitive way to put it, but I haven't heard of or know of anyone who would think, well, this is Ireland's opportunity now that Britain is suffering. I mean, to those that want unification with the North, there's an element of this could open up some political doors and the UK is shooting itself in the foot. But no one I know of and no media outlets I know of in Ireland have been salivating and rubbing their hands together at the thought of becoming more radical politically or anything like that. By and large, our Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, our Prime Minister, in other words, he's been very even-handed, very calm. And our Foreign Minister, Simon Coveney, has also been very impressive, very reserved, even when the most ridiculous things are lobbed in his direction by people who really should know better. And I'm no fan of this current government, really. I do think the change needs to happen in Ireland, that our two-party system needs to change. But I do have to give credit that our Taoiseach and our Foreign Minister have done very well in handling the situation. And for most of us in Ireland, we want things to proceed calmly. We don't want any extreme violence because we've seen where that leads. And we know that going down that road doesn't solve anything, doesn't bring us anything good. And we also are quite sad, for the most part, that this has actually happened. Because the situation that was set up before, all the stuff with the Good Friday Agreement and everything, and now all these complications have come up, and certain amounts of ugliness have been shown by the British side too towards Ireland, which, I mean, most people in Britain have been lovely and have been very regretful about the whole thing. But I spend far too much time on Twitter.com as it is, and I do find myself, even, and you know me, Tom, as someone who wouldn't wave the tricolour or anything else, but it grinds my gears sometimes when I saw that I can't remember her name, but she suggested that, a British politician suggested that, well, they should try and blockade the Irish, they should starve the Irish into agreeing to these terms that Britain had.
That's not a great choice of words there.
Not a great policy, considering what happened with the famine and how sensitive that is. Still to this day, especially when we see things like that, and then it drives home the impression that the British aren't really sorry for what happened in Ireland. And I have to say, I did get very emotional the last few years when you had a great rapprochement between our two nations, where Queen Elizabeth II came over and met with our president, Michael D. Higgins, and they had a dinner together. And while it was couched in politics, and while it was probably not as satisfactory as some people wanted, it was still an incredible gesture and an incredible act of reconciliation. And the problem with Brexit, the problem with all this stuff that it has created, is that it shoots that whole thing in the head. All this progress that has been made, all this progress that has been made between Ireland and Britain, and all the reconciliation, all the genuine efforts to make peace possible between two peoples that have always fought against each other, and only in the last few decades has that finally come to an end. And I do believe that Irish people aren't looking at this as an opportunity, and they're certainly not waving the green jersey. I've honestly never heard that before. It could be put in some other places that I don't tend to read, but no one that I have seen is waving any green jersey. I mean, it's a few days until St. Patrick's Day, so there'll be certainly a lot of green worn then. But I haven't really seen anyone specifically say, oh, I'm so glad this is happening to Britain because now violence is going to start up again, or extreme politics and all this kind of jazz. People are apprehensive about the financial impact, but politically they're quite reserved and quite, I suppose, they want it to blow over, but they also they want it to be, if possible, contained. If it can't be stopped, let's contain the damage as much as possible.
Well, that's good to hear that, you know, at least some parties, some nations are comporting themselves with some dignity. Because in the big picture, and to wrap up, I think today, you know, whether you agreed with Brexit or disagreed with Brexit, it's become a fiasco. And, mm-hmm. you know, such a fiasco is, what has this done to the future stability of the EU? Like, will it lead other nations to look for the door? You know, I'm thinking of the Yellow Vest protests in France, or of Italy's populist government who sort of ran on disaffection with the EU. Is this a bump in the road of history, or is the EU really approaching some sort of existential crossroads?
Well, I'm gonna borrow a phrase from one of my students that said it earlier on when I asked this question to them. And he said that it seems to him as though Brexit is two things at once. It is both seriously worrying to the EU, to other member nations, but it is also the best medicine for them to see how painful it is and almost how fruitless it is to try and leave something like the European Union. And bear in mind as well, Britain only joined in 73, along with Ireland and Denmark, whereas other nations like France, like Italy, they were part of the original, what's called the EEC6, so the European Economic Community Group of Six, that essentially founded the European Union.
Yeah.
So it's impossible to imagine, for example, Italy, which has been pretty much comforted extensively over the last few years, as part of its membership in the EU, and certainly in France as well. It's impossible to imagine France not being part of the EU. I mean, for all the Yellow Vest protests that have happened, I mean, there's been an awful lot of work done behind the scenes between the Germans and the French, and publicly as well, that suggests that it is impossible. And I don't think, even when Marie Le Pen, the more far-right candidate for the mm-hmm. French elections, even when she was running and people were even voting for her, those that voted for her, not all of the people that voted for her, wanted Marie Le Pen to take France out of the EU. Because what do you do when you do that? And how does that work for France? Just like, how does that work for Italy? And all these concerns, we haven't even talked about immigration or anything else like that, but all of those concerns, I mean, I think people are starting to realize that it's not as simple as blame the EU and then once we get out of the EU, everything will be fine. Because first of all, getting out of the EU is not as simple as we should just leave, or let's just leave, or let's just get on with it. Like, that's just not how international politics works. It's not how international law works. And people are starting to, hopefully in time anyway, they'll realize that. And certainly in the rest of the European Union, they've already realized that. And even though there's populist movements, even though in Poland there's a not very favorable right-wing government, and in Hungary, Viktor Orban is not doing very nice things, he is absolutely not going to leave the European Union, because he knows full well that as bad as it is now, it could get far worse if he's outside of the bloc. But that brings another question, Tom, that this idea that if Theresa May does return with a deal, or if she wants to get this extension, it's all very well for her to say what she wants when she's in Parliament, but it depends upon the European Council. And the European Council is the assembly of the 28 heads of state from the different member states, which is, I always thought it was ironic that in order to get this deal passed, it requires a democratic act from from the European Union, something which the democratic deficit was always pilloried, and to a certain extent it's reasonable to pillory it. But this idea that to progress any further, the European Council needs to actually give its okay is quite an interesting situation. But yeah, to your point, and sorry for keeping on going on tangents here, the European Union, I think it's been given a very short, sharp shock. But even looking at the ways that it's thrown its lot in behind Ireland, resolutely defending Ireland and defending Irish interests. Mm-hmm. It's been very impressive and very reassuring for us to see that, even as something as minute in, like, I mean, looking at the grand scheme of things, 500 to 510 million people living in the EU. I mean, who the hell cares about these 1 million people living in Northern Ireland? But it matters to Ireland, and because it matters to Ireland, it matters to Brussels. So it is good and reassuring to see that the EU has our back. And I think we are moving closer and stronger together because of that. Now, that doesn't mean that we're looking for a European army. And that's something that people often say, well, it might be bad Brexit at the moment, but I mean, at least we're escaping the European Union army plan, as if that's even a thing. And like people talking about it, Emmanuel Macron talking about wanting to have a European Union army is like Poland talking about Poles not having any role in the Holocaust. It doesn't make it true, you know?
Yeah.
Ending on a super controversial note there, but you catch my drift.
I do. I do. Well, Zach, that was a great talk. I'm very happy to listen to you go on tangents. They're just so full of passion and knowledge, and this is why people tune in to listen.
Ah, yes. Well, it's been my pleasure, and thank you very much for those listening. We had some serious technical problems, and Tom was an absolute doll, being very patient and allowing my computer to essentially repair itself before our eyes.
Well, I am nothing if not a doll, so thank you.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure. I could talk about this stuff for another hour. It's so nice to be given free rein and not have any restraints on my opinions or my views or anything else. So hopefully I haven't sent people into an angry tailspin and they'll be coming back for more another time.
Well, if they do, I got your back. So
no, thank you so much. Perhaps we should do this every single week.
I don't know if I have time for that, but anyway, Zach Figurin, seriously, thank you so much for speaking with us. You know, you have a lot of knowledge on this topic, and I know people were very interested, even asking on Twitter to get some insights. So hopefully this is a nice little St. Patrick's Day listen for them, and Aaron Gobra.
Yeah, thank you very much. And sláinte, as we say. And let's say, hopefully, if you're listening to this, maybe you'll listen to it with a beer or two and you won't take it as seriously as I have. And you'll cheer up a wee bit. It's a great time to be alive, and it's not all doom and gloom. So, yes, I hope I didn't depress people too much. Thank you so much for having me on, Tom, and I'd love to come on again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers, Zach.
Sláinte.
Long may never. Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.